Reopening the state, fixing our unemployment system, writing poetry in a pandemic. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis has a task force to help determine the best ways to get Florida back to work. We'll discuss the challenges of protecting life while trying to get the economy back to normal. Also,
a lot of people are relying on donations from labor unions, from food banks, and free food distribution lines just to be able to eat.
Florida's unemployment system already had a lot of problems, so when more than 1.5 million people tried to apply for benefits, the system crashed. We'll discuss what's being done to help catch up and get people the help they need. Finally, perhaps staying at home is leading to some artistic creativity. Richard Blanco joins us to explain how you could find poetry in the ordinary. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, Florida is experiencing a bit of an identity crisis. From Jacksonville to Melbourne, there have been images of beachgoers enjoying the sunshine. In the northern part of the state, some businesses have begun cross-border work in Georgia, which started reopening over the weekend. Meanwhile, in Palm Beach, Miami-Dade, and Broward counties, all beaches are still closed, and the number of coronavirus cases keeps going up. These three counties make up 60% of the state's total number of cases. So what's the process of reopening South Florida? Should it be different from the rest of the state? What can we reopen? Maybe you own a business and you're thinking, I'd like to reopen. Can you do it safely? We'd love to hear from you. 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. I want your thoughts. I want to hear what you think we should start to reopen now. Well, joining us to discuss this are representatives of the state's Reopen Task Force. Republican State Senator Manny Diaz Jr. joins us. He's from Miami-Dade. Senator, great to have you back.
Hey, Luis, great to be here with you today.
Also joining us is Palm Beach County Mayor Dave Koerner, who's on the task force. Mayor Koerner, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
So, Senator and Mayor, you both, you know, again, represent parts of the state that have been the hardest hit by this pandemic. Governor DeSantis talking about reopening the state, but in stages. We just heard from him actually before the program, wants to take it slow, do it right. Again, we see differences from the northern part of the state to the southern part of the state, but Mayor, let me start with you. Is Florida ready to reopen? Is South Florida ready to reopen?
Well, I can't speak to Florida or South Florida. I can speak to Palm Beach County and my local community. And I get a sense that, on one hand, yes, the people are ready to get outside. They're ready to do some recreational activities. They're very cognizant of the ongoing threat of coronavirus. And I think collectively there's a belief that as long as we follow the strict guidelines that the governor put forth and perhaps model them to match our community a little bit more closely, that there is an expectation that in the near future that my neighbors will be able to get back to work to some extent.
And when you think about reopening, I mean, we're talking about like parks and maybe the beaches to an extent, but like what part of the economy do you see opening first?
Well, and that's really the goal and mission of the task force that Governor DeSantis has assigned to us. And I know the senator and I both serve on that task force. And really, it's a holistic review of all the different facets of our economy and which ones might be low-hanging fruit in the near future to open back up. Obviously, there's some nuances and some complexities to the tourism industry at large, Disney World, things of that nature. But I think here locally and throughout the state, there's a sense that, hey, you know, the everyday mom and pop shops can get back to work so long as we have, you know, some very strict social distancing guidelines, the use of masks, things of that nature. And of course, here locally, we're focused on trying to get some recreation open from a local perspective versus the economy, which Governor DeSantis has taken, you know, very aggressive action on, and we're following his lead.
Senator, we talked with Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez last week on the program. They're looking at parks, marinas, and golf courses, again, with the social distancing still enforced. Based on task force conversations and with public health experts, can these three be done maintaining that social distancing? Do you think you can enforce that?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's great to hear from the mayor. I actually had the honor of serving with him in the Florida House before, so it's great to hear from the mayor, and he's doing a great job over there in Palm Beach. But I agree. I think you can, and I think the reason that those are important, even though there are many critics, is we have to understand that there are side effects from this quarantine, lockdown, safer at home, whatever you want to call it, and that is you have people at home that could have anxiety, mental health issues that could be exacerbated by this being at home. You have domestic violence issues. You have alcoholism and substance abuse that could be exacerbated by this. So I think that when you talk about opening recreational areas or open spaces in a safe manner, I think we can do it. I think you can provide social distance measures, continue to have people wear masks, stay 6 feet away, and do passive activities. We're not looking at people doing 5-on-5 full court basketball or, you know, being up against each other and congregating, but having families be able to go out, take walks, hit trails and do those type of activities, have individuals shoot baskets if they like, you know, as long as there's not multiple people and congregation of people. So I think it's very important, and for the statewide perspective, open up our state parks, allow for some of those social distancing activities, especially in other parts of the state. When it comes down to South Florida and the Tri-County area, you know, we have density, we have a larger number of cases. So I agree with the mayor. I think we have to take a different approach, maybe a little bit of a slower approach in some things. But I think that it's good that we're having the conversation of preparing to open up parts, sectors of our society and our economy.
All right, I want to go to the phones. I've got Leo in Miami joining us now. Leo, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Just curious as to, you know, opening up things is great, but the really best way to get this thing and the economy going is to get people back to work. And I don't understand why they haven't come up with a system of different types of cards handed to people that are tested. Some are asymptomatics, these asymptomatics. You could be 3-5 days having the virus, but they don't even know it. And there has to be a way of classifying these people, giving them some sort of a card, perhaps a color-coded certificate, like they do when they vaccinate people for travel into other countries. There has to be some way of knowing and perhaps a more cost-effective way of testing people so that they can carry these cards, perhaps testing on a weekly basis to get key economies and key industries back to work and having them identified as clearly either yellow, green, red, some sort of a system where they're asymptomatic, you know, symptomatic or asymptomatic, but, antigen positive, I think this is a problem.
Yeah, Leah, two very good points here. Thank you so much for the call. Mayor Koerner, let's go to his first point, which is, again, classifying people, you know, whether they've been tested, not tested, have had the virus or not. Do you think we're going to get to the point where we have to do that?
Well, first of all, let me thank the caller for the question and the idea. And listen, everything's on the table. This is sort of a case of first impression, both for our state, our country, and in many respects, the world. So there's no bad idea out there. I think with regards to the labeling and classifying citizens, there may be some deeper issues there that the community at large may embrace or may not embrace. But ultimately, I think that, and Governor DeSantis has spoken about ramping up our testing even further beyond the great progress that we've made, because testing is going to be an ongoing source of information throughout this time period. I just don't know that we can get to a point right in the near future where there's you know, logistically enough tests to make that an effective strategy. And on the other hand, regardless of testing or not, we want our constituents and our neighbors to be cognizant of the safety requirements that go with this. So, you know, anything that says to the community, hey, let your guard down, don't pay attention to this, we have a system, we're going to rely on it. What I want to see in Palm Beach County to continue is to socially distance and be cognizant of the physical effects of that distancing.
Yeah.
And that's how we win.
And you talked about it, testing, you know, and it's ramping up the testing. Senator, yes, we've increased the testing, but, and this goes to Leo's other point, you know what? We've only still tested a small percentage of the people in our area, in the whole state. So, you know, what about amping up the testing? What are we waiting for?
Well, I agree with the mayor there. I think there's some things I agree with, some things I disagree with the caller. Is testing is important, and we are ramping up the testing. If you've looked at Florida's numbers, we're up over the 300,000 mark, which is higher than most places if you look at it even per capita. the most important thing in being able to open up the economy is, I'll agree with the mayor here, is no matter what we do, we have to maintain these social distancing protocols and even face coverings. We cannot take for granted, because what we don't know is this whole idea about giving somebody a card, we're not even sure what the science says on whether someone can even get reinfected or what happens with somebody after they have the antibody. That's not conclusive yet. So to think, number one, that it's a slippery slope, like the mayor says, that there's some constitutional issues that may come up with that. But number two, how effective is it? And does that get people then to let their guard down? So I think improving testing, improving serological testing to get more of a grasp. I think what we're starting to see in the Miami-Dade study that came out from the University of Miami, the preliminary numbers is there are many more infected people than what we originally thought, which means this virus is probably much more contagious than we thought originally. But it's also, it looks like the mortality rate is also much lower if you open up the denominator. So having said that, I think that we cannot let our guard down. We have to, our first weapon of defense against this is social distancing and maintaining those protocols, opening up the economy while doing that.
And you're talking about the survey from UM. Yeah, and we discussed that last week with Mayor Jimenez. Again, the number 800-743-9576. Your thoughts on how South Florida, not the state, South Florida, should reopen. What can we open first, and how do we do it safely? You know, talking about the economic toll, really, especially on small businesses across the state, according to Smart Asset, this is a financial services institution, Miami-Dade, Broward, Monroe, and Palm Beach counties, top five in the state for residents that depend on small business income. Mayor Koerner, what are you hearing from small business owners in your region? What's happening to them right now?
You know, it runs the wide spectrum of emotions right now. This is a difficult time for a lot of people, and you can't put, you know, small business owner into one silo and say they react the same way. I've had small business owners that have walked away from the business, and I've had small business owners that have benefited immensely from the PPP program. What I do find as a constant within that thread is that categorically, the small business owners are a hardworking bunch of people that started their own business and made a success out of it. And there's a sense that we'll bounce back, and there's a sense that we're going to help each other regardless of what the immediate outcome is. And I really believe that, you know, that's the mark of an American, and I'm excited about that chapter of our future.
Are those small businesses, though, I mean, getting any of the funding from the federal government, and is there any county or state money that's helping them stay afloat right now?
Well, listen, I can't speak for the U.S. Congress. I know that there's been a lot of aid sent to various places through Congress and presidential action. The senator, you know, they're above my pay grade when it comes to that kind of stuff. But what I can tell you is here locally, it's not just loan programs or grants. I mean, we're talking, if you look from my home down to Lantana, there's a line of cars just waiting for food, okay? So, you know, when I say small business owners run the full gamut and spectrum of impact, some small business owners have received funding from, I'm sure, from the county and short-term loan programs. Other businesses are just trying to
feed
the family.
All right. Sorry, we're getting a little connection problem there, but we'll get that resolved here. Senator, you know, Governor DeSantis visited Orlando Health over the weekend, and during the press conference on Sunday discussed the process of allowing for elective surgery in hospitals. How much would elective surgery help county hospitals? Have you heard anything from doctors?
Yeah, I think from doctors and from the hospitals themselves is it looks like we're stable when it comes to number of COVID patients. And what's happening is the hospitals and all the medical providers are looking like they're going to get to a point where they have to start letting people go, because there's just not enough going on with just COVID to be able to keep those people on. And by the very same note, you have people that have been waiting for, sure, maybe not emergency procedures, but elective procedures that are important. Telling somebody that has a blown out knee that needs a knee replacement, that's living with pain, that it's not essential or an emergency, it may be easy for us, but not for that person living with that pain. So I think we need to start to look at what elective procedures, how the hospitals put in a protocol to make sure that COVID patients are in a COVID wing and we keep it safe for the patients, and at the same time allow that medical economy to start moving again as well.
I want to go back to the phones. I'm going to start with Larry in Delray. Larry, welcome to the program. Larry, you there?
How are you?
Yeah, go ahead, Larry.
How are you doing?
Doing all right.
So, the unemployment issue. Back in March, when everybody started filing for unemployment, the system was overburdened. It was crashing. On April 10th, I followed the Governor DeSantis' recommendation. I went to the FedEx. I got the printed form. I filled it out. FedEx sent it in. Haven't heard a word. I went on the site. The site said it's crashed. The site puts you on to hold on for somebody to handle your case. They say that they're overloaded. They can't call back. They tell you to go to their website. On the website, it tells you to go to the email portion, the contact portion, to fill that out. And you do that. And what happens is it comes up with an error.
Okay.
So here we are a month in. I have no answer. I don't know if I should refile. I don't know about the retroactiveness. And there's more people daily filing.
Yes, yes. All right. Well, Senator Diaz, you know what? I mean, we're going to talk about this in the next segment as well. But, you know, what is the legislature doing? Is there any consideration of bringing the legislature back for a special session to fix this problem? And again, as Larry said, what about retroactively helping these folks? Because they've been waiting a while.
Yeah, so first of all, I don't think there's anything for the legislature to do. The governor has the ability to get this thing greased and moving, and he has done that. He's made adjustments. He's admitted that there was an issue, that the system had a problem. Thousands of people have been transferred over to this department to process these applications. And I wish I had a direct answer for him, but we have been servicing constituents in our office and trying to get them answers. And the truth is that it depends on when people applied and where they are in the process. But what has been done is there has been the governor has allowed for retroactivity back to March 9th. Now, what I would caution some folks is to understand that that's state unemployment. The weeks start to count from the moment you start to receive it. And the $600 from the CARES Act didn't take effect until March 29th. So there are scenarios where people can actually hurt themselves and miss out on some of those funds if they claim the retroactivity. So that's why they have been very cautious in making that move, but they have done it, and they are evaluating it to show for people who will benefit from it and make sure that they're not hurting people.
And one of the other things, though, isn't the legislature actually responsible for raising, you know, that weekly amount? Because Florida has one of the lowest. I think it's like a $275 a week.
Right, but Lewis, now there people are going to be receiving $875 per week because $600 is coming from the federal government, and the state can't.
That's not forever. That's
right. It's not forever. It's July 31st, but neither is state unemployment. It's 12 weeks. And we don't, as a state, we cannot print money. So the issue is that the state has a certain number of resources that, regardless of whether the legislature comes back or not, we just don't have an endless amount of money to allocate to this. And that's why right now we're working with the combination of the state and the federal dollars that were allocated. And we will reevaluate that and reevaluate our situation probably in June before the new budget year starts. But right now, we have to allow these funds to go out. There's 610,000 claims that have been processed. 209,000 have been paid. There's been 1.8 submitted, but of those, only 800,000 are unique, which means several people, quite a number of people have applied multiple times.
So, yeah, and you said 1.8, that's 1.8 million. But briefly, because of something you just said, is there a concern that the state coffers could run out? Could this bankrupt the state?
Well, right now we are in good shape because of our fiscal policies over the last decade to finish the fiscal year. So to be clear, the state will not run out of funds and does not have to reduce any of our programs through June 30th, which is the current budget year. We did pass a budget before we left session in March, and that budget has not been addressed by the governor. I think the governor is waiting to see what the situation looks like as we get closer to June, because the current budget lasts through June 30th, so there's no action required before then.
Okay.
But at that point, we need to make decisions based on projections. And the honest truth is, we don't know. We don't know what it's going to look like going forward, because this, the effect of what's going on the economy is going to trail deep into the future of the year.
It will. Sure. It will. And for the state and for localities as well. Mayor Koerner, let me come back to you on this idea of reopening. And one of the biggest concerns we hear from public health officials is that you start to reopen and then there's a fear of a second spike in the coronavirus cases. What are the plans, you know, by the task force? You know, if we start to reopen and then we see a surge appearing, if the data tells us that.
I don't want to speak on behalf of the task force. I am honored to be on the executive committee, and I appreciate the trust the governor put in me. You mentioned that my colleague and friend, Senator Diaz, is a Republican, and I happen to be a Democrat. I served in the legislature, but, you know, pretty apolitical and apartisan in that regard. And so I don't want to speak on behalf of the task force, but I can tell you that there's developed a political lens on how to look at coronavirus, and that's an unfortunate revelation. I haven't seen that lens play out in Florida, and I'm proud of our leadership in that regard. What I can tell you is, as a local county mayor, a local official making day-to-day decisions, I'm not going to speak to the task force or the economy, but I will speak to, you know, our initial concerns about when we open up recreation, which I'm hoping to open up here in Plumage County probably sometime on Wednesday or Thursday. It's a microcosm of my neighbors getting back out into the community. And of course, there's a concern about, are my neighbors and constituents going to take this seriously? So what I'll say to that is, much like anything in life where human emotions are involved, there's a carrot and there's a stick. The carrot is we're going to broaden our recreational opportunities to have a healthier, happier lifestyle during these difficult times. But on the flip side is there's going to be some strict enforcement of these rules. And, you know, a lot of elected officials get a lot of bad press because there are consequences for violation of these guidelines and regulations. But it's health, safety, and welfare, and that comes first. And I trust my neighbors and my constituents to do the right thing. We'll evaluate throughout this entire time period. And like some governors and mayors have done, they've taken back things that they put on the table because of bad conduct by the community.
Yeah.
And that will always be the case.
It is the balancing act that we've been discussing, protecting public health and also thinking about the health of the economy, which is part of our public health as well. I want to thank our guest today, State Senator Manny Diaz Jr., Republican from Miami-Dade, and Palm Beach County Mayor Dave Koerner. Gentlemen, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Stay safe.
As you as
thank
well.
Thank you. Bye, Senator.
Bye. See you later, Mayor.
All right. And again, we share with us your thoughts. Always find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Your thoughts on how to reopen safely. Still to come, thousands of Floridians are still waiting for their unemployment benefits. We're going to take a closer look at why they're stuck in limbo. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Florida's website for filing for unemployment benefits reopened this morning. It had been shut down since Thursday for maintenance. The website suffered from crashes and design problems, forcing hundreds of thousands of Floridians to wait weeks to receive their benefits, and many transitioned to the paper applications out of necessity. For the past decade, the state has made a number of changes to the system, including the number of weeks individuals can receive benefits, who qualifies for them, and how much you get. New York Times reporter Patty Mazzei explained some of the history to us and how people are navigating that system now.
Help us first understand why Florida is near the bottom when it comes to getting people the unemployment benefits they need.
The systems have been overwhelmed everywhere with applicants, given the unprecedented record number of people who have lost their jobs in the coronavirus pandemic. But Florida has an especially glitchy website that has just crashed repeatedly when people try to apply. And the state was already among the stingiest in the country in terms of actually allowing people to qualify for benefits. It's also a state that does not give benefits for as many weeks as other states, and it caps the benefit at a maximum of $275 a week, which is also among the lowest in the nation. So that combination of a problematic website, overwhelmed with claims, in the system that already made it difficult to people to qualify for unemployment, has just resulted in chaos.
Patty, you were a reporter at the Miami Herald under Rick Scott's administration. What actions were taken under his leadership that fundamentally changed how the unemployment system operates in Florida?
Well, they decided to rebuild the website before Governor Scott came into office. His predecessor, Governor Crist, chose the company that would rebuild the website. But it was under Governor Scott that not only was the website rebuilt, but the legislature and the governor enacted a series of reforms that were right after the Great Recession and were really intended to keep corporate taxes low. And in order to do that, that's why they had to limit the unemployment benefits for workers. So once the new website went into place with these reforms, they started seeing problems immediately in terms of having people qualify for benefits. And in fact, the state performed several audits over the years, especially about the website problems, but they were never really fixed. And so you come now to the DeSantis administration having to deal with sort of the result of all of that, which is this breakdown in the system.
We should note also, you did reach out to him for comment, and his spokesperson gave you an answer.
A spokesperson for now Senator Scott said he was not going to engage in dumb political squabbles about the website. He also pointed to the fact that the reforms that were enacted by the governor and the legislature resulted in Florida actually beefing up its unemployment trust fund, which is sort of the bank account that pays for these claims. But of course, things were much different just a few months ago when the economy was booming and the unemployment rate was 3%.
As you mentioned, I mean, this isn't unique to Florida. A lot of states have run into this problem. Their systems weren't ready for a massive amount of people to start filing for unemployment. But have you seen states that have gotten it right, or at least kind of, you know, righted the ship before it got really bad?
That has been one of the biggest issues in Florida, which is how long it has taken to try to resolve the issues. For example, it took a month for the governor himself to be able to say how many claims had been paid of all the claims that had come in. And when he got that number, it was 4%. It was very small. The state still has not been able to build a portal for gig workers and independent contractors to apply for unemployment. Now, they normally would not qualify for state benefits, but they do qualify for special federal benefits during the pandemic. And many other states have figured out a way to get these folks into the state system to get their money. Florida still has not.
Do I have this right? There is a fund for, you know, to pay out unemployment benefits. And right now, there's more money in it than there was in March 1st?
Yeah, my colleague who I worked with on this story, Sabrina Tavernisi, interviewed an expert who noted that that is one of the indicators to show that the claims have not been paid quickly enough. Some states have already started depleting these trust funds to pay the avalanche of claims that have come in. Florida has not yet. Now, it has been paying more claims over the past week. It's been speeding up a little bit, but we still don't know how many claims have come in total because there were duplicate claims. People had to file on paper and also online. And so, yeah, that the number really we should see going down in the trust fund based on the number of claims that have come in, and we haven't seen that yet.
But it's bigger than it was March 1st. So how is it getting bigger?
Because companies still pay taxes to go into it. It's just at some point we would expect to see the funds really start going down as claims get paid up more quickly.
You talked to a number of unemployed folks for the story about their experiences. Tell us about Ernst Vergil, who lost his job at the Fort Lauderdale airport.
He and his wife lost their jobs at the airport on the same day. They had just bought a house in 2018. They have three children, and they, you know, took more than a week for him to be able to get through the state website to file his claim. And a month went by and he still, you know, wasn't getting paid, a month from his layoff. And so he was so worried that it was keeping him up at night that he goes out for drives by himself so that his wife and children don't see how worried he is, because he was one of the few who was able to get through but still not see the money. And that is one of the things that experts will tell you about unemployment benefits. The speed in which they are released really matters so that people can pay the rent, so that they can get food on the table. A lot of people are relying on donations from labor unions, from food banks, and free food distribution lines just to be able to eat.
And that was one of the heartbreaking parts of the story, is that he takes these drives. It's almost like he's trying to hide it from them to protect them. How is he communicating with his family about what's going on?
Well, they're all sort of concerned about what's happening, right? But I think it's it's really stunning as a reporter, and I'm sure this happens to you as well, when you hear people so openly talk about their fears. We interviewed another gentleman in the story, Jose Garrido, who was also saying, I have two children and I am just terrified. I'm short on the rent and I have 2 months of power bills due and I don't know what I'm going to do. And to hear people who have never had to apply for these benefits in many cases, who are used to sort of being independent and fending for themselves, tell you that they can't sleep at night because this is keeping them up is really heartbreaking.
Was there any update on his story? Was he able to get through in his application?
He was, but he was still waiting for benefits. People kept telling us that they kept checking their bank accounts every day to see if any direct deposit had come in.
I'm speaking with Patty Mazzei, reporter at the New York Times. Florida's website for unemployment benefits has suffered tremendous problems since the beginning of the economic shutdown, and you could read her full story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. So the servers went down over the weekend. They're back up. But at the beginning, they had to replace or they had to add more servers just to be able to handle the number of applications. Have they resolved that problem? Is the system able to handle the number of claims coming in?
You know, it's hard to tell because they've had to take the system down so often. For example, a lot of time for like 12 hours at a time at night to do upgrades, that people just don't know what time to log in to, if not apply, at least check the status of their existing applications. They had to create a separate portal sort of as a makeshift application system, but that data still has to be migrated to the original system with all these, 100 new servers that you mentioned. And now you have up to 2,000 state employees from other agencies who have been diverted to input this data by hand, from the paper applications that come in by hand, to input them into the computer and also to answer people's calls, because people are calling to try to get help. They're calling to try to reset these PIN numbers that they need in order to log in. So it's really levels and levels of bureaucracy that has slowed this down.
And as you said, Florida has really one of the stingiest, unemployment benefits paid out at max $275 a week. And the governor said that he can't change that. So who can?
He has indicated that he would need the legislature to step in. The legislature is not in session, so they would need to call some sort of special session. Now, I should say that Democrats, including past Governor Crist, have said that the governor does have the authority, that if he has used executive action to waive some of the unemployment requirements, which he has done, that he should be able to waive this as well and increase the benefit. The federal government is paying an additional $600 a week, so people are seeing an augmented benefit, but that is for as long as the federal government benefit lasts, and then we will still have the low underlying Florida benefit beneath that.
And the 1.5 million people who filed so far, only a small percentage have received benefits. The governor keeps saying the system is a jalopy. It's unacceptable. But does he give us any indication as to how fast they're going to be able to fix this and get more people that money as quickly as possible?
Governor DeSantis has said this is his top priority, and he appointed a czar, essentially, to take care of the system. The secretary of the Department of Management Services, who normally would not oversee this, was named not long ago to step in over the secretary of the Department of Economic Opportunity, which normally handles the system, basically as an admission by the administration that things were not getting done quickly enough to the governor's liking. And so he had to bring someone new to sort of try to speed things up.
You pointed out that there were numerous audits over a number of years of this system, and it pointed out those audits showed there's a problem with the system. Now, from people we've talked to, we've heard, well, the economy was great. There was no need to worry about the system. But, in your reporting, do we find any reason that this system, why the system cost $70 million plus just to pay to have it and to fix these problems? And how much is it going to cost to keep fixing them?
I don't think we know yet. I think we're in the middle of just trying to deal with the urgent matter of getting people money when they need it the most. And there will probably have to be a lot of work done on the back end, either to fix the system more permanently or to find out what went wrong exactly and why the issues were not addressed earlier. It clearly was not a priority of this administration or the previous one to address the shortcomings of the website. And, when you had maybe 100 people applying for unemployment a day, as the governor said, was happening, you know, as recently as January. Maybe it was not a big deal. I mean, the Department of Economic Opportunity, according to the governor, was talking about how it had too many workers, too many idle staff members to be dealing with unemployment. And here we are, where they've had to transfer people from other agencies to help, because in a crisis is when, you know, that's when people really need the safety net.
And we know that the governor had also loosened some of the restrictions on getting unemployment so that the money would get out faster. But have all of those restrictions been lifted? Have they tried to make it easier? Just get the money out. Get it out to everybody so everybody can at least have something now.
You know, they've waived things like the wait week, which is the week that people had to wait to apply for benefits or to get their first payment. But it has not gone back to as early in March as some people actually lost their jobs. And so some people have been struggling to say, hey, I lost my job on March 15th. You really need to make this kick in from before, you know, March 20th or 29th or whenever it was. There was another requirement where people had to log into the system every 2 weeks to certify that they have been applying for jobs and show that they had been looking for work. Well, they waived that requirement too, because there are no jobs to be had, as the governor has said. But it was strange because he waived that requirement or said he wanted that requirement to be eliminated, but then he needed to follow up a couple weeks later with an executive order because he said what he had asked for had not been implemented by the previous person in charge. And so it seemed like there were a lot of obstacles in the way of getting rid of these elements. And the people who actually have been using the system will tell you that they log on and sometimes they still get asked about the 2 weeks that they're supposed to be looking for work. And it's like they haven't removed that box in the online system for whatever reason, at least for some people, right? We don't know, because there's so many applicants and so many cases. I don't know if this is going across uniformly, but it seems like there's actually difficulty in activating or disactivating parts of the website in order to comply with these waivers that have been put in place precisely so that people don't have to log in twice a week and further burden the already overwhelmed website.
What's the official statement from the state as to what they're telling people about the wait?
I don't know that they have said anything new other than they are working as hard as they can, that this is their priority, and that the reason they've had to like turn down the system is that they're doing whatever they can to speed this up, that it's sort of short-term pain for long-term gain. But they have been trying to underscore that they're eliminating unnecessary bureaucratic hurdles, suspending requirements that would typically be in place, and doing what they can to help. But they acknowledge that it's a big problem.
We are hearing that other states are concerned that they're going to run out of their unemployment benefits. They're even talking about the possibility of bankruptcy. Is there any concern from the state of Florida? We heard from the governor or anybody that we might find ourselves in that situation?
He has really not said that. There have been some cries for a special session from the Democratic side of the aisle, but Republican lawmakers who control the legislature don't think that that is necessary just yet. But, you know, this all changes so quickly and moves so fast that we'll see how things go down the line.
So, Patty, I mean, we've been trying to get a hold of folks from the DEO, but I mean, are they open to talking? And as you said, I mean, they have a new czar, but have they been transparent? Have they been talking and sharing what's actually happening?
Secretary Satter, who is now in charge, spoke to the press when he was named to this job, and I think has given an interview or two. To us, we got some, you know, statements sort of trying to address some of our questions, including that they were going to try to deal with some of this stuff on a case-by-case basis, depending on the issues that individuals had. But mostly, it was helpful that they got together this dashboard with the updated number of claims, you know, every day. But that's a fairly recent development from the past week or so. It's been hard to get individual questions answered because I think they're probably dealing with so many of them.
So, Patty, having said that, are you skeptical in any way of the data?
What is difficult to know is what the total number of claims is because of this a duplication we're seeing from people who tried to apply online and did not know if they got through and then submitted a paper application. The number of original claims that the state talked about was about 850,000. The ones that they have been able to certify as unique claims, right, that are not duplicate, has been lower than that. But the total number of claims they have gotten has ballooned to more than a million. And so the denominator, right, the total that we're talking about is the one number that I think all of us are looking for. And we just don't know that at this point.
That was the New York Times reporter Patty Mazzei. You can read her full story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, Poetry for Isolation, a conversation with Richard Blanco. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. This pandemic's given us a lot of free time. Perhaps you ventured into your creative side. I know I have. I'm writing more, and I returned to drawing and painting. What creative spark has this ignited within you? April is National Poetry Month. Cuban American poet Richard Blanco has been sharing some poems online from his followers, like Mara T on Twitter. My body craves fruit, and I'm doing the best I can, eating a tin of peaches in my underwear. And Daniel D, because the barbershop is closed on this windy day, we cut each other's hair in the sun and watch the robin take locks to their nest. Richard Blanco was selected as President Obama's inaugural poet in 2013, has taught at Florida International University, and his latest collection of poems is called How to Love a Country. He's with us today to talk about an event happening tonight at 6 p.m. with the Miami Book Fair called Poems for Isolation. You can find out more info on that on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Richard Blanco joins us now via Skype. Richard, great to have you back.
Great to be here.
Very different, I know. But how has this pandemic changed your life? What has it done for your writing?
Well, I mean, in one sense, my routine as a writer, being a full-time writer, I'm kind of in isolation and quarantine most of my life. I think in terms of the writing, it's given me a lot more time to reflect. I'm trying to write my, trying to write my virus poem, so to speak, but I've never sort of encountered a situation, an event, something that is sort of like a moving target. Like when we have a tragic event or a happy event, like a wedding or 9/11 or whatnot, something happens and we write about maybe the aftermath, the feelings. But this is a moving target, and so I keep on working on this poem over and over and over again. But the feelings change. There's new information. There's hope, and then despair, and then hope again. And so, that's been a little bit different. I've never quite had to approach a poem this way. But other than that, still doing my work and trying to stay focused.
It sounds like you're coping all right, though.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm back up in my home in Maine, so. It's a small rural town, so I think social distancing is kind of like the rule of the day, period. There's only 2,500 people in the whole town. I'm doing rather well, but I think like most of us, sort of in this sort of moments of like, oh, life is normal, and then suddenly realizing what's really going on, and you're like, what? So going through a lot of mixed emotions as well.
Yeah. This is fascinating. You're asking your followers on social media to submit poems that are helping them get through this time. Where did that idea come from?
Well, I think, we turn to poetry in times like this always, times of great sorrow or great joy. We always turn to poetry because it offers us a different way of looking at something. It offers us a different dimension. It offers us, a way to see the silver lining, perhaps. It offers us language to be able to communicate our despair or whatnot. It offers us solace. It offers us some light in the midst of darkness. I think when you have to force yourself to put into words what you're feeling, which is what I do for a living, and I do this with every aspect of my life, you're forced to think things through, right? And not just sort of be confronted and be bombarded by just news and media and whatnot, and this bit of information, that bit of information, but to really sort of hone it all in and see what am I really feeling, what am I really processing. And it sort of, in a weird way, lets you take some sense of emotional control of your life. And I think, I like all arts. I'm not going to just up poetry, but obviously I have a bias for poetry, but, something about having having to write down what you feel and work through that and realize that there are these surface emotions, but there are deeper emotions and deeper realizations that are happening with us in our subconscious that start surfacing in the writing.
I am sure that you've gotten some interesting submissions. I'm wondering if any of them have really left you speechless.
Well, I love that one about the cutting the hair outside, right? That was like this is like a perfect example of a poem. I kind of jokingly have said before, you know, like poets, when things are really good, they look for what's really bad. When things are really bad, they look for like what's really good. Like, I don't know, it's the nature of the poet, I guess. But to see such a tenderness and such a quiet moment that we've taken for, you know, that, I mean, even like a haircut, you don't even want to see my COVID hair right now. You know, I miss my barber and like the warm, you know, like, but just then taking that and seeing something beautiful in having to switch up life, right? And appreciate something that would have gone unnoticed simply because we're too busy with our regular lives and not even appreciating the things that run by us every day.
I'm talking with Cuban-American poet Richard Blanco. He's with us today to talk about an event that's happening tonight at 6 p.m. with the Miami Book Fair. It's called Poems for Isolation. You can find out more on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And by the way, don't forget, this is National Poetry Month. We still got a few days left here. Richard, let's talk about the event tonight. It's online. Obviously, it's not in person. But yeah, tell us a little bit about this and how it's going to actually all go down.
We're going to do about 15 or 20 minutes. I'm going to share a few poems, and then it's going to be a really healthy question and answer period that I think will be very, very sort of engaging. So we'll that's how it's going to run mostly. I'm going to share poems from my most recent book, How to Love a Country. And one of the things we'll talk about is how poetry, much like songs, our favorite songs or music, how they have, you know, they have multiple lives. They, every time, you know, you pull out a poem that you like, somehow when you read it a year, 2 years, 10 years from the first time you read it, it offers us something different because the world has changed and we have changed, and poems, again, like song, can sort of offer us some other dimension. And so I've been looking at my own work from this book and going like, oh my God, Like I like to say, my poems are smarter than me. Here's stuff that I'm, even in my own work, I'm starting to see differently because of the current crisis that we're facing. So I'm going to sort of offer that up as a way of continuing a conversation and working through the complexities of all that we're feeling these days.
All right. Every time I get you on, I get you to read me a poem, and I hope I have enough time. If anything, could you give me a minute's worth of one of them? You have Imaginary Exile is going to be one of those poems, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so tell me when to stop.
Go ahead and start. I'll stop you.
Sure. So I'm just imagining, like the title says, my own exile, as if my mother, like my mother had to leave Cuba. And so thinking about leaving my home in Maine and what would that look like? Imaginary Exile. Dawn breaks my window and dares me to write a poem brave enough to imagine the last day I'll ever see this amber light, color the wind, breathing life into the dark faces of these mountains that I know by name, risen from the bedrock of the only country I've truly lived, resting on the same earth as this house in which I'll never rise again. A poem that captures me making my bed one last time as the sun climbs the maples. I'll never again watch burst like fireworks into fall, or undress themselves, slip into snow's white lace. Never again the spring giggles of my brook or creaks of my floor. Never the scent of my peonies or pillows. Never my eyes on my clouds or my ears to the rain on my rooftop in this country. A poem that finds a word for the emptiness of suddenly becoming a stranger in my own kitchen as I sip my last cup of coffee, linger with the aroma of my last meal, my hands trembling as I toss leftovers, wash dishes, eat one last piece of bread I'll never break again, and cork a half-empty bottle of wine I'll never finish. A vintage I'll keep savoring like memories through my mind's palate. A poem that lists which parts of me to part with or take. Give up my orchids and dog to my neighbor Jewel, but keep our stairs goodbye. Leave the china and crystal, but box the plastic souvenirs. Forget my books, but pack every letter and card I've saved. Not the gold chains that won't buy back my life, but stuff all the loose photos like crumbs in my pockets I'll need to live on.
Now I have to be the heel, and I have to stop Richard Blanco, and that just really makes me feel terrible.
That's a good place.
I'm that guy. I'm the guy who had to stop you. Again, watching Richard live is so worth it, but obviously we can't do that in today's world. But it's at 6 p.m. tonight, and it's worth watching. Please do so. Richard, as always, stay safe. I know you're probably a lot safer than we are being up there, but stay safe and have fun tonight.
Same here. Same to everyone. I hope to see ya tonight.
It's tonight at 6 o'clock. It's with the Miami Book Fair. It's called Poems for Isolation. More information about it on our social media. And that is Cuban American poet Richard Blanco. Also want to add that Oh Miami has a list of events going on for National Poetry Month. You can find those on our social media as well. Well, that's our program for this Monday, April 27th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, elections and the pandemic. The primary season is continuing across the country, although many states have delayed voting. What did we learn from the March primary that could change how things work in November? We're going to be speaking with Broward County Supervisor of Elections, Peter Antonacci. And by the way, if you have a question for him, some concern you have about the upcoming election, find us on Facebook and post your question. Plus, Miami Police Chief Jorge Colina is currently battling the novel coronavirus, and he joins us remotely to discuss his treatment and how policing has changed during the pandemic. The department has seen an incredible drop in crime since the shutdown in March. All of that coming up tomorrow on the show. Remember, you can always find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Go back, find any of our old shows online, WLRN.org, or just find the podcast. Listen anytime you want. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. As always, practice social distancing. Stay safe. We'll talk to you tomorrow.